want to start off by telling you two things. Most of you have seen Ed Beckley, or some of you have seen Ed Beckley, who says that, you know, the guy, the evangelical real estate salesman, who says, let me tell you the most important thing that I've learned, watch what the poor people are doing, and then don't do it. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to tell you the most important thing that I've learned in some 15-odd years of doing work in cultural studies, and that is, steal shamelessly from Stuart Hall. And the second most important thing that I've learned in that period of time is that about 80% of the time, popular culture is an ideological concept. And what I mean by that is that it's a concept that quite frequently represents real phenomena in ways that deflect attention away from their changing social and historical character. Popular culture becomes often treated in that realm of abstractions like man, like woman, like society, dehistoricized, ripped out of any kind of sense of active agency. And in a sense, in that way, it has a tendency to become part of a kind of reified view of the world that, sadly, so often we academics are so expert at reproducing. But you want to ask, I think, I mean, if you're talking about popular culture, you want to ask, how could that be? I mean, surely anything popular culture is a concept that has an historical character. Surely it has a demystifying character. It's demystifying, obviously, in the sense that the way popular culture has often been used, it becomes a concept that helps to break down claims made by elite culture, by dominant cultural practices, to having some kind of naturalized position of privilege. In a sense, often that's the case. And yet, that kind of deconstruction almost always occurs in a way that's captured within a set of stifling conventional frameworks, aesthetic elitism versus pluralism, or pluralism versus radical cultural criticism in the Marxist tradition. What I want to do this morning is outline a kind of framework, or another way of understanding the popular, as a series of shifting oppositions and contradictions, a shifting field of cultural struggle, a distinctly historical set of compromises, oppositions, and incorporations. And then what I want to do briefly is apply that kind of analysis to looking at popular games and to sports, and particularly the social production of the definition, the social definition of sport with respect to how we understand it. Few things dramatize more graphically, I think, an understanding of popular culture as a series of shifting oppositions, compromises, struggles, a set of forces and oppositions whereby one set of practices are rendered dominant and another set of practices are pushed to the cultural periphery. And then what I'd like to do, at least in passing, sort of at the end of this little talk this morning, I should give you a 7-inning stretch or something, I suppose, but I want to talk about the way in which television, and partly television technology, is often seen as being involved in the making of modern sports as popular culture. Now, in order to do that, I have to go over some background definitions. It's cultural studies, if it sounds a bit too much like cultural studies 101, I'm going to apologize. But I want to start with these general definitions. The most common sense view of what popular culture contains is generally to see popular cultural practices as those practices which can be said to be popular because masses of people listen to them, read them, enjoy them, watch them, and so on. And this is a kind of market definition of popular culture. It's this definition that's most often led into discussions about the alleged manipulation and debasement of the culture of the people, seen in the abstract, versus the idea that the market, matched with modern machine and communications technology, has finally allowed for the full expression of democratic cultural practices or the ultimate realization of consumer sovereignty. Posed in those terms, we see the juxtaposition of a kind of mass society perspective versus a kind of pluralist perspective on audiences and their capacity to express themselves and consume freely as individuals in consumer culture. Now, within this kind of broad definition, we find the debates framed on false versus real needs between the supposedly genuine or authentic culture of the people versus the technically produced and commercially dominated facsimile. It's that kind of debate that sort of, can you imagine walking, I mean, I walk down the street and sing to myself sometimes, you know, two all beef patties, lettuce, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, and you think, my God, I'm doing that. And then people say, oh, you go to McDonald's. I do go to McDonald's. I eat there. It's cheap. It's fast. And the food comes in plastic containers. It's not that bad. I've eaten worse. So, but nonetheless, you have within this, so we've got a kind of frame of reference within this initial definition of what constitutes the popular as a framework within which a whole set of discourses essentially fight it out. Now, what I want to say briefly about that particular framework is to suggest that it's, that the emphasis on cultural power and the emphasis on mass consumption is important. The emphasis on pressures of technology and on the market, their capacity to incorporate, all of those emphases are important. But so often this entire framework is captured completely in a kind of, in a whole variety of reductionisms and a kind of elitism. Now, what I mean by reductionisms are, paper with glue at the top. What I mean by reductionisms are the tendency to reduce culture to simple expressions of some otherwise constituted social order. A social order that whereby cultural practices, popular practices, are somehow shaped and determined by the technical, shaped and determined by class, shaped and determined by gender, and in a sense tend to be seen passively as the reflections of these social determinations in ways that completely lose the ability for these practices to be seen as the creations of human agents, as real cultural practices that are lived and experienced. And I think this first definition also contains within it a tendency to overemphasize the degree to which the products of the people, to overly romanticize them sometimes. And I think this tendency and the idea, in other words, that somehow working class activities of certain types are somehow superior to the mass-produced activities of the marketplace, that somehow people are cultural dupes tricked into mass consumption and as a result aren't really aware of the kinds of options, choices that they make, that they can't reappropriate the kinds of products of mass cultural expression and make them mean something else. I think there's a tendency to overstate these things in that framework. Now, there's a whole other way of approaching popular culture, and that whole other way is to a kind of broader, more anthropological definition, something that's completely severed, at least in many respects, from the mass society frameworks, the idea of understanding popular culture as the kinds of activities that the masses or masses of people consume. And this broader, more anthropological definition of popular culture is basically to look at or to say that popular culture includes all of the things that the people do or have done. Language, conventions, mores, everyday cultural practices. It's to see popular culture as the distinctive expression, the way of life of the people. And one of the interesting things is the extent to which this definition, and this is the definition that the folklorists, who's anybody who's ever been to a popular culture meetings, can see this definition kind of routinely rehearsed over and over again. What this definition does is it lends itself to a kind of commitment to excavating the esoterica of everyday life in a whole variety of situations, to talk about it, to try and convey it, to make it live. And it lends itself, I think, to a kind of empiricism in the study of popular culture, which reduces cultural studies to the ever-expanding description of an accumulation of cultural items. And the more esoteric the cultural items you unearth, the more scholarly your particular perspective happens to be, or particular research happens to be. Now, the biggest problem with this framework in popular culture focuses on the extent to which power isn't dealt with at all, the power to define the popular, and to determine the limits of what kinds of practices are going to be understood within popular culture. What is it? What principles allow us to understand what it is that's to be defined as popular or not popular? And I think it seems to me that that particular question opens up another way of understanding popular culture, which is to focus first and foremost on the structuring factors, the structuring oppositions that shape and define what it is that comes to be understood as the popular and what it is that comes to be defined as falling outside that particular range. Not just for academics. We can study the career of that concept, I think, and try and tease out its ideological implications, but also to look at practices, everyday cultural practices, and try and define them in these terms. Now, the point that I want to make is that if we focus on the structuring factors, the structuring oppositions that shape and define dominant definitions, the field of the popular, we have to ask an historical question. We have to ask, what are the structuring principles that create this particular field of oppositions? And we have to ask, what kinds of factors historically have allowed some things to be in dominant definitions of cultural practices and other things to be excluded? And when we do that, when we focus on the tensions and oppositions between what belongs to the central domain of the dominant culture and to the cultures of the periphery, then in a sense, I think, what we've forced ourselves to do is to try and break out of a reified understanding of popular cultural practices and to think about it much more historically. And when we think about it more historically, we're also forced to recognize that there are a variety of connected phenomena here that have to be understood. It's important to relate popular culture to the social production of the work-leisure distinction, for example, in the 19th century, if we're going to talk about industrial capitalism. It's important to talk about popular culture in the context of the two sites of the capitalist labor process, the home and the workplace. It's important to try and explore the connectedness of these phenomena to popular cultural practices, because we can't really apprehend them unless we do that. The process of preferring and positioning certain cultural practices as legitimate, as acceptable, as dominant, while other practices come to be pushed to the periphery, can only be apprehended in this connected and historical way. Now, having sort of said that, I want to try and show you just briefly how sport itself and thinking about sports fits into this kind of way of thinking about popular culture. You see, people use sport all the time as an abstraction. When we talk about sport, we talk about sport as if we know what it means, as if there was a kind of coherent world of sport, as if the frame of reference, what is included in sport and what is not is included in sport, as legitimate gaming activities, for example, we know that. We know, for example, that some activities which once were defined as sporting, torturing dogs, chickens fighting to the death while people bet on them, those kinds of things, by and large, fall outside of the framework. They still go on, actually. They go on in Surrey and Squamish and places like that. But they... Come on, Mark, you were there last week. These kinds of things go on, but they're not generally included within the framework of what people talk about when they talk about sport, and particularly, interestingly enough, when they talk about sport in popular culture, because largely, when people talk about sport in popular culture today, they tend to use that first definitional framework that I talked about, sport in the context of mass production, mass consumption. Now, I think it's important for us to understand that another element of sports that are often talked about, and we have to, and sports are incredibly mythologized. And we understand, I mean, sports are, let me be blunt here, sports are about class and they're about masculinity, by and large. I mean, they're not, at first, people don't often see them in those ways because people see sports often as the universal quest for drama through the skilled use of the body, ritual celebrations of physical prowess. John Berger has a novel, A Painter for Our Time, where the life's ambition of the male hero is to paint the 1948 Olympics in London. And he has a line in there where he says, I've seen games of football where I thought, where I imagined I could see everything that I ever thought the productive relations among men might be. Of course, but there are no women in that particular framework except to perhaps do the kinds of things in the home that reproduce the opportunities for the men to go out and play. But nonetheless, in the history of sport, there is this also tendency to celebrate the search for community. Kind of, sport is often talked about. The American philosopher and theologian Michael Novak talks about sport in the context of a whole variety of Platonic kinds of things. Sports, he said, are true in a way that few things are true. They give us glimpses of a whole variety of forms that we can hardly... It's a commitment to order and bounded space. It's a reaction to chaos and to formlessness. It's the voluntary submission. It sounds like Durkheim in Moral Education. Liberty is the fruit of regulation. We all agree to be bound by the rules that we create. By our social contract, we can be more together as we are as individuals. It's all good, solid, liberal stuff. But the point is that the understanding of that particular social definition of sport isn't natural. That particular understanding of sport was something that was won. It was produced historically. It was produced largely by the males of a particular fragment of the middle classes in the period between roughly 1840 and the early part of the 20th century. It's in many respects a Victorian and a bourgeois conception of what civilized bodily practice ought to be, what civilized, acceptable cultural behavior ought to be. It's about a definition of the body and about community and social interaction that was constituted against the background of the need to control the workplace. The separation between work time and leisure time, the delineation between them. In other words, if we think historically about all of the things that people have variously defined in some way as sporting, the old field sports of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, riding to the hounds, fox hunting. Another inflection in the social definition of sport was to talk about gaming behavior as sporting. We still have some of these as residual elements in what sporting or the word sporting means. And then later in the 19th century, sporting came to be understood as the muscular Christian activities of Victorian gentlemen, organized around two or three things: making the useless useful. Sports had to be made useful. They couldn't be hedonistic. They had to somehow be drawn into the Victorian utilitarian culture of the late 19th century. They had to be subordinated to the time needs of the industrial labor process, to the weekend. They had to be tied into the often Methodist concerns for order and sobriety that were characteristic of that culture. They had to be made civilized. They had to be made respectable. The rough elements had to be shorn from them before sports could be drawn effectively into the center of Victorian culture as a dominant set of cultural practices. And yet, in a residual form, these other kinds of elements of sports, the profane expression of the body, the often violent expression of community, the drinking, some cases the dog fighting, the blood sports, and so on, that didn't necessarily die out. And the market, the Victorians always had an ambiguous relationship to the market. I mean, it was good in one sense, but bad in the other. Baron de Coubertin, the founder of the modern Olympics, whose most favorite book was Tom Brown's School Days, said that commercialism was sort of the bane of the 20th century. Of course, I mean, the Baron wasn't against capitalism, but he had a kind of residual sort of elitist concern about commercialism as the harbinger of mass culture. And in that context, he resurrected the Olympics, the modern Olympics, as something that he thought might be a kind of cultural therapy, something that could stand against the forces of commercialism and the homogenizing elements of industrial society. to recreate a kind of aesthetic and elite culture. He was tremendously influenced by a kind of hygienist movement that was going on in France at the time he was writing. Now, against that context, you begin to see the market in the social development of sport. The market picks up on certain elements, but it picks up on some elements of Victorian culture, but those elements have a kind of built-in ideological predisposition against the incorporation of the market. So what happens is, as sport, like every other area of popular cultural life throughout the 19th century that became commodified, sport was drawn into a whole set of contradictory processes. It's really interesting, people who talk about the degrees to which capitalism incorporates working class behavior, it's actually better to see it as a contradictory relation. For every worker that was encouraging their, or for every industrialist that was encouraging their workers to go to Sunday school, to show up on time, to become civilized, there were lots of entrepreneurs willing to sell them drink and festival and so on. And I think it's important to see this kind of contradictory notion as lying at the center of what capitalist society is all about. It's important, in order to have any kind of dialectical understanding of the society, that is absolutely central. And the marketplace, as sports became commodified, as athletes' play developed exchange value, as athletes' abilities became labor power, as teams became commodities, as cartels formed, they often formed in the rough and in the working class districts. They often became sort of seamlessly interwoven with other areas of popular life, with the tavern, or were associated with them, organized in taverns. And they fought a kind of pitched battle with a social definition of sport that demanded that sports be pursued on a part-time basis, that sports be tied to temperance. Chesterton once said that anything that's worth doing is worth doing badly. You try and think now, could the Canadian Ski Instructors Alliance sell ski lessons if anything that was worth doing badly? Of course they could. Because for the Canadian Ski Instructors Alliance to sell you ski lessons, or for the local racket club to sell you racket lessons, you have to believe that if you enjoy a physical activity at a low skill level, your enjoyment will increase as your skills and your mastery increase. That's not natural. It's a social and historically constituted perception of what the range of acceptable and enjoyable practices within the framework of sporting is all about. And you see, in the transformation from anything that's worth doing is worth doing badly, in the transformation to the notion that sports should be somehow pure and pristine in the marketplace, in the transformation from that to you need to become more skilled to enjoy something at a higher skill level, or you need to have Jimmy the Greek to tell you the point spread to really enjoy football games on a Sunday. In that massive transformation, what you have is you have a set of procedures whereby television becomes a central player. Not a determining player, but a central player. Television plays an important constitutive role in the social development of sporting practices. There's a new book out called How Television Has Transformed Sports, where the guy mourns nostalgically for the loss of our old games and talks about how television has brought in too much money, too many commentators, too many games. And what we see here is a kind of technological determinism of the worst kind. In fact, sports as a commodity form were available a long time ago. And what television has done, what television technology has done, has partially allowed for the refinement of that commodity form. The residual Victorian athleticism has helped to secure an orderly market. Commercial sports, often rooted in the rough and in the unrespectable, became orderly and became mass culture only by drawing on those elements of the respectable in the earlier Victorian social definition of sport that allowed them to maintain some kind of tie to dominant groups. Now, the point of all of this, I think, is simply to suggest that an abstraction, sport, a set of abstractions, the people, that all of these things, when we talk about them, without looking at them historically, without looking at the kinds of compromises that have been made, the kinds of accommodations, the kinds of victories and losses in some way, without talking about this, and without talking about, say, the relationship of sports or popular music or whatever, to the kinds of structuring oppositions that define what sporting activities are defined as popular at one time or acceptable at one time and not acceptable as others. What social definition of sporting practices is defined as legitimate at one time and not legitimate at another. Unless we are aware of those kinds of concerns, we're forever going to be condemned to talk excessively, as Marx once said, about the present.